Are you prepared to bug out? Infidel Body Armor and an Army Ranger have produced a high-speed DVD and book to show you how to drive in combat, patrol, and how to survive in combat. Skills you'll need when it hits the fan. Go to DrivenDVD.com. DrivenDVD.com.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
Herbs have been used by people since the dawn of time. When Rockefeller introduced allopathic medicine, many herbal remedies fell by the wayside as people put their faith in prescription pills and the world just gets sicker. Here at Heathen Herbs, we look to the past and to nature for answers. We offer tinctures, magnesium skin cream, lip balm, tooth powder, colloidal silver throat spray, and more. Check us out at heathenherbs.com.
You've made a serious investment in protecting yourself and your family. You've purchased the gun, the ammunition, the training, and even secured a license to carry in your state. You know the Constitution and don't believe you should have to pay for a right that you already have as written in the Second Amendment, but you are law-abiding. Now you are considering the legal defense options you should have if you ever have to use a firearm. Self-Defense Fund is a comprehensive litigation membership backing you on appeals, legal expenses, court costs, and more, up to $1 million per incident and unlimited attorney costs per member. Discover selfdefensefund.com for yourself. Any weapon, any state, any time.
You're listening to Resolution Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Our own Vanessa Neubauer has recorded an audio version of the first book ever published by Dr. Pierce, his translation of Dietrich Eckart's Bolshevism from Moses to Lenin, a conversation between the author and the German leader Adolf Hitler. In its pages, we can see how these two men, the poet and the architect of a reborn Germany and a new European order, influenced Dr. Pierce and contributed to his understanding of religion, spirituality, and the biological reality underlying the Jewish power structure. Let's continue with part two of this extraordinary book. When we left off last week, we were discussing the ability of the Jews to mimic the behavior of whatever people among whom they might reside. I give you Miss Vanessa Neubauer.
With startling rapidity, they change their nationality back and forth. And wherever their feet touch, there resounds either the Watch on the Rhine, or the Marseillaise, or Yankee Doodle. Dr. Heim does not once question the fact that our Warburgs, our Bleichroders, or our Mendelssohns are able to transfer their patriotism as well as their residents of today to London or to New York on the morrow. On the sands of Brandenburg, an Asiatic horde, Walter Rathenau once blurted out about the Berlin Jews. he forgot to add that the same hoard is on the Isar, the Elbe, the Main, the Thames, the Seine, the Hudson, the Neva, and the Volga, and all of them with the same deceit toward their neighbors. Our charmers and wizards, however, distinguish between respectable and not so respectable, between settled and newly immigrated, between Western and Eastern Jews, and, if worse comes to worst, they shrug their shoulders and mutter, "Every country has the Jews it deserves." It means nothing to them that it was a Jew who coined this fine-sounding phrase, nor that, in the case of Germany, considering the quality of the Jews we have deserved, it becomes a resounding slap in the face. "All Israel stands openly in the British camp," announced the American Union leader Samuel Gompers in 1916. And that includes the German Jews, too, as the American Ford well knew. He has written of the faithlessness of the so-called German Jews toward the country where they live, of the fact that they have united themselves with the rest of the world's Jews toward the ruin of Germany. "Why?" jeers the Jew. "Because the German is a vulgar scoundrel, a backward medieval creature who hasn't the faintest idea of our worth. And we should help such rabble? No, he has the Jews he deserves." Such arrogance is indeed staggering to behold. I reminded him of Russia. Before the revolution, the Jews condemned her as a downright sewer of vileness, even though they were the evident vermin in that sewer. Now, the same Jews are at the helm, and woody-whoop, the same Russia is a great nation. "In the year 1870, he rejoined, "we Germans had the privilege of being a great people. The Jews considered that the time had arrived for replacing the French emperor, who had become undependable, with a pliable president. This also seemed an excellent opportunity to establish the commune. Thus, the heroic German people. No wonder that right behind our princes and generals, a pack of gesticulating Jewish financiers rode into Paris. Meanwhile, though, we have sunk back down into the pack again. The press. That select tool of the Antichrist, as Bismarck called it, has designated us as Boche and as Huns. But have patience. The more quickly we approach Bolshevism, the more glorious we will become again. And one fine day, it will be the English and the French who are the scoundrels. One doesn't need spectacles to see that. I am a British subject, but first and foremost a Jew," screamed a Hebrew years ago in a large English Jewish newspaper. And another. Whoever has to choose between his duties as an Englishman and as a Jew must choose the latter. And a third. Jews who want to be both patriotic Englishmen and good Jews are simply living lies. That they could venture things of that sort so openly indicates how overrun with Jews England already was then. The stronghold of European Jewry had its origin in the period between Cromwell and Edward VII, I emphasized. Since then, however, the center of Jewish activity seems to have been transferred to America. They have had a good footing there for a long time. Zumbart maintains that it was Jewish money which made the first two voyages of Columbus possible. A Jew, Luis de Torres, is supposed to have been the first European to step on American soil. And, topping everything else, the Jews have recently claimed Columbus himself as one of them. "That's not surprising," he laughed. "Everyone who has somehow played a role in the world, the dear Lord included, is a Jew. They even have Goethe and Schopenhauer on their list. And blessed be he who believes it. For my part, I contest them Columbus as well as Torres. Ocean travel was much more hazardous then than now. According to Hauser, I replied, Columbus was an Aryan, perhaps even of German descent. It's all the same to me, he responded. As far as I'm concerned, he could have been a Zulu. I'd sooner attribute his deed to a Negro than to a Jew. Completely aside from that, it's clear that they have had America by the throat for quite a while, I continued. No country, writes Sombart, displays more of a Jewish character than the United States. We have already seen a consequence of this in the World War. In 1915, at a time when the true Americans hadn't the slightest thought of a war against us and, in fact, were so disposed toward us that any indication of a possible conflict of interest could have been smoothly and amicably settled. A secret advisory committee met with President Wilson for the sole purpose of preparing the country for war against Germany. And who was the chief wire puller in these nefarious activities, which were set into motion a full 2 years before the engagement of the United States in the war? The previously unknown Jew, Bernard Baruch. I believed that the war would come, long before it came. He later calmly explained to the special committee of Congress which confirmed all this. And no one got up and beat the crafty scoundrel to a pulp. The resolution of the Jewish High Command many years ago to unleash the World War is well authenticated, he said. At the Sixth Zionist Congress in Basel in 1903, the president, Max Nordau, proclaimed, Herzl knows that we stand before a tremendous upheaval of the whole world. Good old Herzl. What an idealist. Our charmers and wizards were filled with awe at the thought of this noble patriarch. The scoundrel knew, however, what his filthy people had in mind for us. But Herzl was a Zionist, I interjected. He was a Jew, he said, striking the table with his fist. The word Jew says everything. There is no need for any further distinction. God's chosen people want to have their own God's country again. Catch that. Again. God's people and God's country, neither of which, in reality, ever existed. Every portrayal ridicules for its depravity that general state of affairs which existed for some 600 years in Palestine, till the Assyrians put an end to the mischief. Can you call that a country? Can't one accept the Old Testament as the authority on the matter? First, we read of the uninterrupted murders and plunderings of the other peoples of Palestine, which, naturally, took many years. Then, right up to the last, with the most abominable vileness, one state of anarchy followed another. The pinnacle, the flowering, the glory of Jewish statesmanship, namely King David, was such a rascal that even the unprecedented villainy of the letter condemning Uriah was not enough for him. On his deathbed, he urged his son to murder his old war comrade, Joab. When Cyrus gave the Jews permission to return to Palestine from their Babylonian captivity, the overwhelming majority ignored Zion and remained in immeasurably rich Babylonia. Completely content there, they continued their financial speculations and other activities. In the year 1267, I informed him, there were only two Jewish residents in Jerusalem. Up to the World War, the number of Jews in all Palestine had grown to only 12,000. Even though they had been free to return there since ancient times and certainly weren't lacking travel expenses. The remaining 20 or so millions, exactly how many is difficult to ascertain since the Jews themselves do the counting, fatten themselves upon the sweat of others all over the world. It is hard to understand how tiny Palestine can hope to accommodate this enormous crowd. That's not necessary, he retorted. The point is that it is now official. Israel has remembered itself. Its chains are cast aside. The sun of a new God state rises over Zion. What an act! Finally liberated from bondage. Everyone is numbed with awe. The Jews grin. They have already issued a resolution. I wanted to continue. Yes, indeed, he cried. If anywhere, this is where the cat jumps out of the bag. The resolution of the Pan-Jewish Conference of 1919 in Philadelphia. Quote, the Jews are citizens of the new Jewish state of Palestine, but at the same time they have complete rights of citizenship of whatever countries they choose to live in. End quote. One must read that non plus ultra of arrogance twice, indeed 100 times, in order to be sure one isn't dreaming. Imagine instead. The English are citizens of Great Britain. Each Englishman who chooses to live in Germany or France or Italy retains all his rights of English citizenship, but at the same time he has the complete rights of citizenship of the country in which he is living. Now ask yourself what a scream of indignation, not we or the French or the Italians, but the Jews themselves would raise if the English people had actually made such a resolution. The Pan-Jewish Congress, however, issued its resolution as categorically as a command. This assembly comprised representatives of all the Jews of the world, including the Zionists. Their intentions were, in short, that the Jews should stay where they were and that the new Zion should simply have the purpose, first, to strengthen their political backbone, second, to gratify their arrogance, and last, but most important, to provide them a state where they could carry on their dirty business without fear of detection. I think we can form a pretty good idea of Jewish nationalism from this. Okay, so they are neither national nor international, I acknowledged. What then? In terms of our customary concepts, he shrugged, it really can't be defined. It is a rank growth over the whole earth, sometimes advancing slowly, sometimes leaping ahead in great bounds. Everywhere, it sucks voraciously at the lifeblood of the planet. What was, in the beginning, a swollen abundance will become, in the end, nothing but dried-up sap. Zionism is the visible surface aspect. It is connected underground to the rest of the monstrous growth. And nowhere is there to be found a trace of opposition to this thing. One might say, I laughed, that the wolves have split themselves into two packs. It has been agreed that one of these shall abandon the land of the sheep in order to go live somewhere, quite among themselves, as pure vegetarians. 4. There is one thing, above all, of which we must always keep in mind. He tendered. One thing of which we must always remind ourselves. Great masters of the lie. One need only forget Schopenhauer's words for an instant in order to begin slipping under the influence of their deceptions. To be sure, we also lie. But, in the first place, not as a matter of habit, and in the second place, clumsily. Any really experienced judge of human nature is able to detect the lie of an Aryan, even a very shrewd one. Sherlock Holmes himself, however, would be at a loss when confronted with the Jewish cold-bloodedness in deception. A Jew is only embarrassed when he inadvertently blurts out the truth. If he should happen to deliberately tell the truth, it is always with a mental reservation, thus making a lie even of the truth. Indeed, Luther, I replied, said to the Jews, "You are not a German, but a deceiver, not a Frenchman, but a faker." His synonym for Jew was liar. "That's what everyone who knows them says of them," he rejoined. "From the pharaohs up to Goethe and our time. It has been said in every dead and living language, in Greek, Latin, Persian, Turkish, English, French, or what have you. One would hope that these universal condemnations throughout the whole world would give our charmers and wizards at least a little to think about. God forbid. Not even Christ was able to reach them. He stood there among the cringing Jewish rabble, his eyes flashing, the very image of scorn, and his words fell among them like whiplashes. 'Ye are of your father, the devil, and the lusts of your father ye will do.' He was a murderer from the beginning and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it." But to our charmers and wizards, that means no more than the unintelligible stammering of a child. They delude themselves by believing that to be only a stern but well-meaning lecture of the Lord to his beloved people of Israel. I underscored his irony. "Christ," he continued with a raised voice, "was never other than perfectly straightforward and frank. God, not to feel the fact that their two fundamentally different worlds opposed one another. In Palestine, after the Babylonian captivity, there was a great lower stratum of non-Jews ruled over by Jewish moneylenders, powerful through their usury. One can read that in the book of Nehemiah. Editor's note. Especially in chapter 5. Zombart says that it leaves absolutely nothing to be desired in the way of clarity. The outstanding point is that the real population, composed of oppressed peasants, was of an entirely different race than the Hebrews. Gradually, the Jews forced their religion on them. Christ himself growled about that. Quote, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For ye encompass sea and land to make one proselyte." End quote. To the Jews, Galilee was the land of the Gentiles, whose population sat in darkness, as they impudently imagined. They said, "Can there be any good thing come out of Nazareth?" And, "Art thou also of Galilee? Search and look, for out of Galilee ariseth no prophet." The Hebrews were so firmly convinced of the non-Jewish ancestry of Christ that they counted him among the especially hated Samaritans. We live and learn. There are many more such examples. One could hardly recommend a better policy than that, which lets each man find salvation in his own fashion, I stressed. The tacit assumption in that policy, though, is that each man's fashion should involve some sort of decent sentiment, some genuine belief, and not just a contemptible Phariseeism. This distinction should have been expressly emphasized long ago. It wasn't, and the religion of the money changer has received the benefit of this misguided tolerance. Christ was not so tolerant. With a whip, he put a stop to the business of the children of the devil, even though he had said, "Love your enemy." "Yes," he replied, "but we must understand what Christ meant by enemy. We can love an honorable and decent enemy, even a brutal one, who is frank and forthright in his enmity. And at the same time, we can beware of him. But Christ never dreamed that we should love men whom no love whatever could dissuade from their implacable determination to poison us, body and soul. Indeed, he himself did not do that. On the contrary, he continued to strike with his whip as hard as he could. And the words that he flung with indignation into the faces of the rabble breathe of irreconcilability itself. To me, he acted very proudly in the founding of his religion. There was very little contradiction between his sermons and his deeds. Why, then, have the pious never followed his example? They least of all. They mercilessly persecute even their decent adversaries. As a matter of fact, only their decent adversaries. Their eyes remain closed to the most cunning bunch of swindlers in existence. The Bavarian People's Party, for instance, knows quite well that we are defending the Christian foundations of our nation without mental reservations. They also know, however, that we can make no common cause with them as long as they adhere to their present policies. And so they turn to the Jews, hoping to remain in power with their help. They surprise themselves. Dripping with friendliness at first, the Jews turned on them murderously when they had gotten the upper hand. That was inevitable, I agreed with him. Fortunately, the Jews would not be able to provide us with that same sort of dreadful experience, for we do not betray and murder our own flesh and blood for the sales of profit. So far as we are concerned, the Bavarian People's Party could even remain in office, provided they clean the manure out of their pigsty and perceive the correctness of our views. We are not willing to tear ourselves apart just for power. But we want Germanism. We want genuine Christianity. We want order and propriety. And we want these things so firmly established that our children and grandchildren can remain satisfied with them. They consider that impossible, he said, and therefore they consider our program nothing but empty phrases, of no more sincerity than the empty phrases with which they consciously try to peddle themselves to the people. But our goals are not only possible, they are certain, even if we don't attain them tomorrow. But first, a beginning must be made. So far, never and nowhere has there been a truly social state. Everywhere and always, the upper crust has leaned much more strongly to the principle, what is yours is mine, than to what is mine is yours. These wise ones have only themselves to blame for the fact the lower stratum, full of rage, now is committing the same error. The Jew is able to take advantage of both these groups. One of them provides for his affairs, the other carries them out. Therefore, we oppose them both. We will put an end to unfair privileges as well as to slavery. Decidedly, I replied. Our front stands against both left and right. A strange situation. From two directions, we must ward off attackers who also fight one another. The Reds scream at us as reactionaries, and to the reactionaries, we are Bolsheviks. From both sides, the Jew directs the attack on us. The lower stratum doesn't see him yet, and thus, hates us from sheer stupidity. The upper stratum sees him but thinks it can serve its own selfish purposes with him, and thus shoots us in the back, more from unscrupulousness than stupidity. One really needs a good deal of faith under such circumstances in order to maintain one's courage. Which we have, God be thanked, in 100 ways, he said, laughing, as he stretched himself. No words were spoken more directly to our hearts than, "Be not afraid." And that was supposed to have been said by a Jew? Those creatures of eternal fear? Crazy! 5. Every time new and promising opportunities for meddling have arisen, he brought out, the Jew has been immediately involved. He has demonstrated an uncanny ability to sniff out like a bloodhound anything which was dangerous to him. Having found it, he uses all his cunning to get at it, to divert it, to change its nature, or, at least, to deflect its point from its goal. Schopenhauer called the Jew the dregs of mankind, a beast, the great master of the lie. How does the Jew respond? He establishes a Schopenhauer society. Likewise, the Kant society in his work, in spite of the fact that, or rather because, Kant summarily declared the Jewish people to be a nation of swindlers. The same with the Goethe society. "We tolerate no Jews among us," said Goethe. "Their religion permits them to rob non-Jews," he wrote. "This crafty race has one great principle. As long as order prevails, there is nothing to be gained," he continued. He categorically emphasized, "I refrain from all cooperation with Jews and their accomplices." All in vain. The Jewish Goethe Society is still there. It would be there even if he himself had expressly forbidden such knavery. "With exactly the same right," I interjected, "the two of us could join a Talmud society." What impudence that would require! Inconceivable. "Not to the Jew," he replied. "To him, impudence has no meaning. He is only able to think in terms of advantage or disadvantage, profit or loss. One must approach him with a different sort of measuring stick." "Our charmers and wizards," I rejoined, "all fall for their trick. Goethe, Kant, Schopenhauer seem to be nothing but babblers to them." "Bah, Goethe," he interrupted contemptuously. "Not even the saintly Thomas Aquinas is able to reach these people. The great father of the church has described in his writings our relationship with the Jews in terms of a voyage on a ship. The Jews, embarked on the same vessel with the Christians, play a characteristic role. While the Christians are occupied with sailing the ship, the Jews plunder the storeroom and bore holes in the hull. St. Thomas recommends that they should be relieved of their booty and chained to the rudder." "What an atrocity! How unchristian!" "Poor Jews! One can learn so much from them, at least according to Doctors Heim and Schwer." And so the world goes on, governed with the same wisdom as in the time of Joseph's Pharaoh. "Namely, by statesmen," I completed, "who are so busy ruling that they completely fail to notice that not they, but others, actually rule. By men like Tsar Nicholas, who indulged himself in the same self-deception and got a bullet in the head for it." As early as 1843, Disraeli gave us a hint of what we should expect there. "The mysterious Russian diplomacy is organized by Jews," he boasted. "Also, the mighty revolution which is in the making in Germany is evolving entirely under the leadership of Jews." "Most of our revolutions," he said, "whether initially with desirable goals or not, have evolved under Jewish leadership. The revolutions of vulgar predisposition were, for the most part, the work of Jews. And those with loftier tendencies were soon subverted into a darker course by Jews."
You've just heard part 2 of Dr. William Pierce's translation of Dietrich Eckart's Bolshevism from Moses to Lenin, read by Vanessa Neubauer. We'll continue this important, insightful work next week, right here on American Dissident Voices.
You're listening to Resolution Radio, Radio, Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
What would your life be like if you woke up each morning with new vitality, feeling better than you have in years, and you noticed a difference in your sleeping patterns, blood sugar levels, and had a sense of well-being overall? There's something that is changing thousands of people's lives, and you could be one of them. It's called Heart and Body Extract. Sharon Harris, co-creator of Heart and Body Extract, talks about the positive effects of Heart and Body Extract.
What happens with the formula Heart and Body Extract is it's giving the body the necessary vitamins, minerals, amino acids, enzymes, and phytonutrients so the body will heal itself. And yes, the body does have the ability to balance blood pressure, balance cholesterol, clean and unclog the arteries. It can also work on balancing the circulation for diabetics. So the body is an amazing thing. It simply needs some help so it has the tools to heal itself.
Heart and Body Extract gets results. To order your two-month supply, call now, toll-free at 866-295-5305. Order online at hbextract.com.
My brothers, my sisters, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. We know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, one beat. 100 hearts, one beat. 10,000 hearts, one beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the alliance, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. Defeat never, victory forever.
Water is the single most important thing your body needs, so you want to be sure it's the best for you and your family. Since 2005, thousands have depended on Berkey Purified Water. The Berkey guy provides the lowest priced filtration systems in every size for incredibly delicious water now and in an emergency. Get to GoBerkey.com or call 877-886-3653. 877-886-3653. GoBerkey.com.
I believe in race. I'm not ashamed to admit it at all. And that doesn't mean one bit that I'm out to persecute or hurt any man because of his race. He can't help what race he is. We believe that each race has particular geniuses and particular faults. The white race has built white Western civilization, and we think the white race should dominate in that area. National socialism fundamentally is the application of science not only to inanimate objects and animals, but to mankind himself. We believe that the communists, the Marxists, have one fatal error in their doctrine, a place where absolutely there's a hole and there's no explanation for it. They admit evolution. They admit that animals vary by breed and that you can breed better and worse animals. Now, how do they explain how there is a sudden dividing line when you come to one particular animal called man? They have no explanation. Time and again, when I've asked them, they have no explanation. They just say, if it's got two legs and it stands on its hind feet, then it suddenly becomes a special being and there is absolute equality. They're all the same. Man is an animal just like all the rest of the animals. He's more intelligent, but he must obey nature's laws. And that insofar as he is an animal, he must obey the laws that pertain to animals. We say that when the white race has produced such a wonderful thing as Western civilization, we should treasure the people that have produced that. and can maintain it. And we should not mix them all up with other kind of civilizations, whether or not they're good. We should certainly try to preserve it just the way the farmer preserves his better grade of stock. We are also, socially speaking, tribalists. You must live as social beings. You have to live with other people. And this is impossible unless you observe certain fundamental laws of the tribe, the ancient Indian tribe, any kind of tribe of people, even a wolf pack, has got to have certain fundamental things. One of these things is leadership. Not leadership by the most popular, but by the strongest and the best. Any tribe or Indian tribe or any group or family should be led by the best and the strongest. Otherwise, it disintegrates. It's got to have group pride and loyalty. You've got to have selection in the mating process, something that we have almost lost now. We believe that it is of fundamental importance to society that the strongest, cleverest, and the best of the men mate with the best type of women who will make good mothers. And when you destroy that machinery, you get what we have now. We believe that you have got to have an organic society. Now, by an organic society, we mean a society, not a dictatorship, but a society in which the parts of the society cooperate together in different functions and in peace and harmony, just the way your body works. Cancer is the wild, uncontrolled growth of cells at the expense of all the rest of the body, and that's what you have in Washington, D.C. right now. Cancer. We believe in private property and free enterprise. It is impossible, we believe, to have a society in which there is any real work going on unless people can get the reward of their effort. And at the same time, we believe you've got to have social justice. You cannot have people who are exploiting and squeezing little helpless people economically. And this is where I get in trouble with a conservative, because most of today's conservatives, I've discovered, are reactionaries. They're real anxious to hold on to their money. They don't care how they have to figure it out. They just want those money bags. And they come up with any kind of rationale to keep it. Every national socialist believes in idealism, believes in something that is worth more than his own one single human life. He's willing to die for something. When you're ready to die for something, then you're alive. And until you are ready to die for something, you have no real fanaticism. And just at dinner a little while ago with some of the fellows there, they said, were telling me, well, it's terrible to be a fanatic. Well, did you ever stop and think how this country got here? How all the great inventions ever got there? Any one of you out there that is not a fanatic on something or other, whatever it is you're studying, if you're going to be a doctor, be a fanatical doctor. Otherwise, you'll be nothing. You'll just be an ordinary old chug-chugging guy, and when you die, nobody will notice it. But if you're a fanatic, you'll produce something great. You'll create. Creativity is fanaticism. Every creative genius has had to be a fanatic. Many of them have been burned at the stake. So we are ideological and idealistic fanatics. Just like the communists, by the way. In between the Nazis and the communists is the great mass of non-fanatics. The TV watchers and the comic book readers. I will say this. National socialism is the inevitable end product, logically, of evolution. If you believe in evolution, you've got to be a Nazi if you think about it long enough. You can't help it. But what happens is people short-circuit it. The minute they believe in evolution and scientific breeding until they come to that two-legged animal that stands up on its hind legs, then all the rules are up. We say that's not possible. You either believe in the scientific method and the truth, and you apply it to yourself without egotism, or else you don't believe in the scientific method and you're kidding yourself. Nazis believe in ruthless application of the truth, not only to inanimate matter and animals, but to you animals. People, all of us, are the same insofar as we are animals and must survive and live as animals. And unless we breed ourselves better, we're going to get worse. That's what's happening. I do worship nature in that I'm humble. When I see the mighty, awesome power of nature, and believe me, I've seen some terrific power of nature, the typhoons off Japan during the war, earthquakes. I've been through some tremendous cataclysms on this earth. And compared to them, the atomic bomb is like a firecracker. Nothing. And when you start to think of the enormity of space, our spacemen are just going around at the very bottom levels of space. They're no place yet. There are over 100 million planets where life, just like here, could exist. And in the face of that awesome probability, not possibility, probability, I say it's ridiculous to be egocentric and say we are the center of all things. Everything turns around us. We Nazis are humble. When I look at nature and realize how ignorant and small and feeble and weak and little we are, Nazism is a philosophy of nature, a way of looking at the world. And as I pointed out, we believe in tribalism. We don't think we're above that. We think that you've got to have pride in your family, pride in your race, pride in your nation. That's not something to laugh at. Patriotism and pride in family and pride in race is something we should be proud of and cultivate, work on, not get rid of. Finally, we believe in morals. We believe in the traditions of goodness, virtue. Now, I told you something about what we are, but I'll do as good as I can in telling you what I think our enemies are. And our enemies, make no mistake about it, are the Marxists. The philosophy of Marxism, I believe, is the enemy of all humanity. It's the reverse of humanity. We say communism itself is the most vicious, antisocial doctrine the world has ever known, and here's why. They completely deny the very basis on which any human order can exist at all. Without humans, or at least without civilized humans, you certainly can't have human order. And the communists say they don't believe in race. They believe in absolute equality. The pygmies, the aborigines of Australia, everybody. Let them all come to Carlton, and they'll all write arias and books, and the cannibals will be producing the music and verses. That's all you have to do is educate them. And this simply is not true. This results in chaos, social chaos, which is what we have now. They don't believe in enterprise. They don't believe that people should work for themselves. They believe that the state should come and tell them what to do. They don't believe in private property. They don't believe that you can keep the fruits of your production. They don't have, above all, they have no spiritual ideal. We say the only thing that's worth protecting with your life is ideals and your family, your race, and your nation. And twice in my lifetime, I've been called upon to go out and risk getting killed. And I saw a lot of other young men doing this. Young fanatics that they made out of it, by the way. They made us real fanatic haters of the Germans and fanatic haters of the Japanese. Nobody protested that that was bad to be a fanatic when we were fighting those Japs, and I assure you we all were. Finally, the communists, if you remember when they first got into Russia, they are against morals. They had free love, no morals at all, everything was have a ball. And the result was they almost tore Russia to pieces. They just fell apart. Now, if you'll notice, they are almost puritanical in Russia. In order to make the thing work, they've had to go back to the very principles of tribalism which we're advocating. You can't work society with a communist pipe dream. Civilization is based on self-sacrifice, on the willingness of men to go out and die for what they believe in. When you get rid of that self-sacrifice, you get anarchy. Civilization is built because I am willing to give up something for my family. And the family is willing to give up something in order to have the town succeed. And the town is willing to give up something so the state can be in business. And the state is willing to give up something so the nation can succeed. Self-sacrifice is the first principle of civilization. Communism has got the fanaticism to destroy you, and it's doing it. And unless you can build up a counter-fanaticism for something you believe in positively, you will be destroyed. You are being destroyed.
Recently, there was a report out that among new babies that were born, this happened last year, minorities were now the majority, that whites were officially the minority.
And they're boasting about it. Khrushchev just said, America's so liberal, they'll never fight. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, but we're going to change that. It won't be quite so liberal. After we've had a chance to make America understand what it is and make it conscious of itself and its greatness and its people and the white race understand that they're worthy of protecting themselves. That they don't have to keep humbling and downgrading themselves while other races are standing up and saying, look at us, how great we are. We keep saying we're ashamed of ourselves for being white. That's a terrible thing. The thing for each race to do is be proud of itself. And the white people
And the good people of this country, when they finally realize that they can do that without hurting or being obnoxious to anybody else, they will finally become fanatics to survive, to keep this great country going.